Hey, folks, you're listening to Chew the Fat. It's Chef Craig Hartman. I happen to be the chef at the most beautiful barbecue restaurant on the face of the earth, the Barbecue Exchange in Gordonsville, Virginia. That's a shameless solicitation. And you're listening to Chew the Fat, the podcast where you come to find out all the things about chefs, food personalities, sommeliers, winemakers, cheesemakers. You try to learn the thing that actually drove them to be who they are, that one kind of spark that was in their soul that propelled them to do the things they do, and how it could relate to us and how we could hopefully make our lives better. And so tonight, unbelievably, we have a fantastic person. This person, I think, could be one of the coolest people that I have ever met in my entire life. And that's hard because I always thought it was me. And no, I'm just kidding. But this guy, he's a sommelier, and he happens to be the chief sommelier for Barbersville Vineyards, which is, I think, undoubtedly the finest winery in the East Coast. He has co-authored some great books, The Modern Gentleman, The Modern Lover, which has definitely helped me. And he's written for many magazines, including, you know, Richmond Magazine, Playboy, Maxim. I mean, this is quite a person. And I think tonight what we're going to find out is, you know, how as a foodie and a wine person, we can better relate to all things food, wine, and life. So tonight we have Jason Sorrow. How you doing, my friend?
Ah, Craig, thank you for the glowing intro. I wish there were a curtain to come peer from behind right now, the spotlight. I feel it.
How about a band? Bum, 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 bum.
Well, you and I have been in front of the band before.
Yeah, we have. We definitely have, you know, and we've had a great time. You know, I think, you know, a lot of people who listen to the podcast who just love food and love wine, and but not all of them are in the business. So some of them might be, you know, work in accounting, or you know, they might do something else where it's not quite as much of a work of passion. And their dream is to be you. You know, the guy who goes around doing dinners, tasting wine with people, teaching them how to be the modern lover, the modern gentleman. I mean, that's, you know, was this something you thought about when you were a kid? Were you like, you know, you were just, you know, like 5 years old, and you were like telling your family, look, you know, put that fedora, you know, in your, or whatever, in your pocket, you know, and, you know, button your shirt up. What, you know, will you put a crease down your on your collar? I mean, how did this all come about?
Oh my goodness, it's a great question. I was fortunate enough to be raised by an entire pack of wild women. I came from a very strong background of matriarchs, and it wasn't just mama, grandma, aunties. It was all those ancillary people, mom's girlfriends and the girls in the hood and the neighbors, and there were always men, but the strong figures were the women. They were the power brokers of the village. And so I kind of grew up as a boy really seeing the world through women's eyes. And, you know, I'm sure if you asked some of my closest friends, they'd say, you know, Tesoro could have gone either way there. You know, the running joke is I'm 51%. You know, I'm half gay on my mother's side. And growing up, you know, not being afraid to go out shopping with them on Saturdays. I mean, my sweetheart actually got hooted at by a woman today. She was taking the kids to school, and you know, here she is walking down the sidewalk, and someone says, girl, those shoes are kicking. She goes, my boyfriend got those for me. So I was like, yeah, you know, I can still pick out some cool treads for my girl. But growing up around women where, you know, they pointed out that, wow, that's a sharp-dressed man, and there's a guy in a hat and a pocket square. And this was in New Jersey, in the 70s and into the 80s, where Atlantic City was just a limo ride away, and people would live beyond their means on credit cards, and that meant there were a lot of cool clothes and a lot of bling. Even though I grew up in a very middle income family, my father was a general contractor, My mother was an administrative assistant, although she went back to school at 40 and became a doctor by 50. And on the eve of her 60th, she's now an incredibly well-respected alternative health, holistic physician.
Wow.
So an example of like this woman who transforms herself. So that transformational quality, that aspirational quality of always wanting to be better, being curious, being adventuresome, having the Sagittarian curiosity and mixed in with the kind of that Jersey bravado, that's a pretty potent stew to find yourself being tossed in. So the modern gentleman, it really didn't come about until I was in my 30s. The book was, I got my publishing contract on my 30th birthday, actually, and there was a lot of stumbling in my late teens, early 20s, mid-20s, until finally I started to figure out, wait a minute, I'm not the modern gentleman. I'm someone aspiring to be a modern gentleman, and I wanted to read that book, but there was this fusty Amy Vanderbilt's Guide to Etiquette.
Sure.
Or you have Emily Post, but where was the stuff on wooing and dating? I mean, do I really need to know about escargot tongs? Like, I'm not, as a 25-year-old, you know, kid hitting the clubs.
Yeah.
I wanted to know how to better be a better suitor. I wanted to know how to mix in charm and chivalry, but not seem like the dandy who was throwing his cape over a puddle. And so I needed to write it.
Yeah.
And just like you, I imagine, with your culinary adventures, I mean, I found myself soaking wet while I was writing Skinny Dipping Etiquette. I imagine that some of your best moments have been, you know, here it is, it's 4 o'clock in the morning after all the guests have gone home and there's a discovery that's made, or, you know, it's after the restaurant lights are turned down and the chairs are flipped over on the table, and over a beer, the conversation with the sous chef leads to, like, hey, let's go and try this. And it's those moments of creativity you find yourself being a kid again. Like, wow, I'm discovering something new. So I find myself perpetually in that state.
You know, I can see you in that state, actually. And I was, you know, this is really, you know, not, I mean, not everybody knows you who's listening to this, but I think they're going to want to read your book and they're going to want to know and check your blog. Where's your blog again? What's the website?
TheModernGentleman.com.
Yeah.
And there's certainly a Modern Gentleman Facebook page, which is fun. I feel like I'm a little more casual on the Facebook page and Twitter. The website, you know, sort of modern Tweetiquette Facebookery. The website almost feels like your home address, and that's like we keep our front lawn well manicured.
Yeah, right.
Like Facebook's like the backyard, and you know that's where maybe I've got a few paint cans back there, and the ladder's on its side, and you can be a little bit more casual.
Sure.
So if you want to find out what's happening this year, go to the website. You want to find out what's happening this week, go to Facebook. You want to find out what's happening right now, follow me on Twitter.
Yeah.
At the Modern Gent.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I'm going to start following you as long as you start following BBQ Exchange. If you want to know everything about bacon, I was thinking maybe you could help me. We'll write The Modern Bacon.
You know, the New York Times asked me recently, tell me what trends you feel have gotten tired. And I said, you know what? That's not just up to me. I mean, I'm not the only one who can chime in here. So I sent out a text to a bunch of foodie friends, and one of them wrote back. He's like, don't you dare call me a foodie. I prefer foodist. Like, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Whatever the term may be. But she wrote back, and she goes, bacon is so over. And someone else wrote back and goes, you know, sliders. And someone else said cupcakes. And I went, wait a minute, I really like bacon. Like, ooh, pork belly. I'll take some right now. Like, cupcakes? Hey, let's... So maybe I'm not the one to be asking that question, because I still think that bacon, whether you want to wrap it in chocolate or around scallops or all by itself, fantastic. I'm in.
Yeah, you know, that person better be careful, you know, because if you put that out at the wrong place, because on Twitter, between all the different bacon areas, I think it's several million followers. So You know, and I think bacon people could get really angry, you know, and they would not be the kind of people that would be like the modern gentleman. They would be like the modern, I'm not going to say it, but anyway, so tell her, be careful. But I actually don't think bacon is over. I think it's even getting bigger. But, you know, talking about the modern gentleman, I haven't read the book, but you always are dressed really good. You know, you look good. You know, you're moving through a crowd and everything. But I noticed, though, over the last few years, you know, being at Fawcett's at Keswick as the chef, I noticed that people started dressing down a little bit. You know, they would take a nice pair of designer jeans and then do the other. What do you call it? Accessorize. I don't know the other pieces of clothing and make it look really good. But you don't see as many people, you know, like really dressing up. It's almost like there's this coolness in not being a halfway sloppy. Does that make sense? Or am I just, is it just me?
It does. Thankfully we've risen past the nadir of the mid-late 90s when grunge was king and we really hit rock bottom in terms of dress. And then we went through like the whole swing revival and people are wearing fedoras and now fashion is back as part of the common lexicon. And while I do think there's overall a casualization of dress, I also find that men have moved the needle. And you go out on a Friday night, and you'll see a lot of guys at 22 to 28 that have a little bit more panache. And the guys that I see, like the schlubs these days, are, I feel like these are the guys who kind of gave up. You know, they reached the best body fat index and coolness in high school or in college. And once they got married, like they let themselves go, and they're the ones who are buying up all the khakis at Target. and it bothers me because they are in positions of influence, whether it's in their career. Like, I have a close friend who easily makes 8 times as much money as I do in a year.
Uh-huh.
And yet, if you saw him on the street, I mean, you're not going to go throwing coins in his cup, but you'd be like, wait a minute. How is it that you're making all that money and you still shop like, you know, you live next to a JCPenney? And I give him a hard time. I say, Donnie, you have an opportunity because you have this kind of prosperity, not to dress expensively, but you can be a thought leader. You can be, he's an attorney, of course.
Yeah.
The young associates coming up behind you can look at you and see that even in your dress, you are congruent, that your whole lifestyle is reflective and integrated. When you see someone who is moneyed but eats really poorly, or if you see someone who's really intelligent but uses a lot of profanity, these to me are incongruencies. And I feel like people are a little bit more in balance when they've got both of those sides feeling more just at ease with one another. So, you know, here's someone who makes enough money that he could shop just at the farmer's market, and all his meat comes from Polyface and all his cheese came in from 50 miles, and he chooses not to. And he chooses not to just out of a kind of ignorance of, well, hey, it came out of a box. How bad can it be? I got it at the Whole Foods.
Yeah, right.
And I'm fighting so that I can go down to the butchery, and I want to watch, you know, Tanya, the butcher, wrap it up in white paper. I'm willing to pay a premium for the conscientiousness, for hearkening me back to when my grandfather would take me to the butcher. Heck, while watching Brady Bunch and there's Sam the Butcher, like, that's an experience to me. I'm not just feeding myself. I'm now taking a part of my day to make that pilgrimage to the charcuterist, to the fromager, to the fishmonger.
Sure.
I've cultivated relationships with them, not in a showy way. I mean, I just want to go and be like, hey, what's up, Ralph? What's cool in today? Oh, man, you got to go home with this rockfish.
Yeah.
All right. You walk into an independent bookstore, and they remember the last 3 books you read. So Barnes & Noble you walk in and there's an end cap because somebody paid them a lot of money to have a stack of their books. I don't want to buy my meat from Costco because they bought six pallets of it from Omaha. I want to go into the butchery who says, hey, we found this really awesome call fat and made this, you know, beautiful pate of the house, and I'm just going to cut you off a slice. Mm-hmm. By the way, try the duck prosciutto. They're opening my mind and exposing me, and they're cultivating my palate. And that's how I've been learning, is letting the experts guide me.
Sure. Sure. You know, Jason, I was in Italy pretty much for a month this last year. My daughter-in-law is a super fantastic natural cook. I mean, she just knows how to take an ingredient that's something ingrained in her. And, you know, not everybody has that. But she lives in Mastrino, Italy, and they have a fantastic butcher downtown. They have a place that makes really great bread, and they have a place that has really great fish, and they have the Tuesday market. And she goes in there, and she'll just put something on Facebook. Look what the butcher gave me today. Look what I made. And, you know, when I was there, I really did have the feeling that, you know, where is that going away in America? Why don't we have that? And I know that in the cities, I mean, I think, you know, Richmond, Washington, D.C., Charlottesville, we have, you know, really good butchers and fish people that we can go to. And, you know, I think that's a really fantastic thing. And what you're saying is, you know, if you allow those people, those experts, the friends of yours that are chefs, the winemakers, and everybody to educate you, you know, it really does, you know, help to elevate your education when it comes to food and just living in general, you know.
Well, you asked me before, you know, did I always want to do this when I was a kid, and ironically, my children, I've got them convinced that I'm just a big kid, like, undercover. And it was funny, one of them said, oh, so that's why you drive the way you do. Like, yeah, I said, exactly. I was like, wee! I promised myself when I was 8, 11, 13, that once I had all the access that the grown-ups had, I wouldn't lose my exuberance, because I felt like, okay, you know, the adults could be having way more fun if they just remembered how to do it. Like, I wanted to drive because I wanted to get to places. I wanted to have money so that I could get my own things. And I wasn't looking forward to being a grown-up so that I could be buttoned up. I was looking forward for the liberation of independence. And living the way I have for the past, let's call it the past 10, 15 years, of really being a man instead of the man child, I've tried to maintain that same kind of exuberance.
Yeah.
And that also comes at, if you can leave the hubris out of it, the I don't know, if you're not afraid to say I don't know, it opens you to have much more potent and, I think, profound experiences with people who know more than you do, because instead of trying to go toe to toe with them,
sure,
you surrender and say, "Hey, I would love to know, chef, how to properly dress a game bird, how to properly debone a rabbit." Instead of, "Oh yeah, I know that. Well, what else you got for me?"
And yeah, sure.
I see people passing over an opportunity because it's more important for them to be right. It's more important for them to feel the equal of the master than to just say, okay, Obi-Wan, I will be your student for a moment.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, here I'm on the, I'll be turning 40 this year, and in some ways I still feel like the little kid. I mean, I have the gray hair, which I guess just makes the disguise all the more perfect, but I'm constantly learning the provenance of things. And when you talked about your daughter in Italy, this movement, the part of the movement, the food movement that thrills me the most, is people getting closer and closer to the source, not just of their food, but even their media. You know, think about how many people you know in bands. Think about the art around your house and how much of it came from someone whose hand actually touched it, someone you know. You know, do you have any cups or plates that were thrown by a potter?
Mm-hmm.
And getting closer to the provenance raises the import of those objects.
Sure.
You know, I have books from local authors that I've read, and you know what? They may not have been the best books that I ever read, but I feel connected to the place and to the person. And it was 2 weeks ago, I went to Topping, Virginia, and I spent the day with Travis Croxton at Rappahannock River Oysters, and I got out on the Carolina skiff.
Nice.
And went out to the beds that his great-grandfather tended in 1899. And I learned about how the Chesapeake is being revitalized, but 100 years ago, you could walk mm-hmm. across the bay, just walking across the bows of boats who were harvesting oysters, and now we're maybe 1% of that. And yet every time you dive into a dozen stingrays or barcats or Rappahannock River oysters, you are indeed saving the ecosystem. And all of a sudden it changed my understanding of oysters from, hey, they're really fun to throw back with Sauvignon Blanc or really good beer, and instead became a, oh my goodness, I'm supporting local aquaculture.
Sure.
I'm supporting this family's entire history. They're high in zinc, and you know,
and don't forget the cleanliness of the.
And that can't be bad. Like, great.
Yeah, and don't forget the cleanliness of the bay itself from the filtering.
Right. So as people get closer to the source, when the tomato they're slicing is still warm because it came out of their own garden, or they're now experimenting with squash blossoms mm-hmm. at the farmer's market, or they're learning about ramps and why people get excited when it's spring, that to me makes them more conscientious consumers instead of conspicuous consumers. And you and I both know there are those conspicuous
sure.
foodists. You know, they're the ones to say, oh, I just ate at Chang's restaurant, and
mm-hmm.
oh, yeah, you know, this is in season, and I got the first ones. And they're the ones who want to make sure they have the first Beaujolais Nouveau. And there's ego. These are the same people who hang solar panels on the shaded side of their house because it faces the street, and they want everyone else to know that they've invested in solar energy. Instead
yeah.
of putting it on the sunny part, which you know no one would see, and but then they wouldn't get the ego. So I'm conscious of raising my family and participating in the movement in a very real way. But at the same time, anytime there's a chef, a sommelier, a restaurateur who makes a big to-do about, hey, we're going green, we're going local, we're going sustainable, that really amps up the volume, and hopefully the masses in these food deserts, places where they don't even have access to fresh food,
true.
Will start to shift their food culture, which then moves them into wine culture. You know, people who get into food and wine, that's when they start learning about the history, the culture, the language. That kind of education becomes very pervasive, and before you know it, you're getting your passport stamped. You've just bought Rosetta Stone. You're on a flight to Madrid, and you're going to be, you know, sinking your teeth into tapas and some cava very soon.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, you can't beat that. In fact, speaking of tapas, that's what we had tonight at Mas,
along with
the good Grenache. You know, so yeah, it was a good night, Jason. I got to tell you. But now, tell me real quick. Now, how did you end up becoming sommelier and hanging with Luca Pasquina and the Zonines?
I'm working on a cover story right now for Sommelier Journal about an emerging wine region. And I'm opening the piece by telling them a little anecdote. It was 2001. You marry a Virginian, you have to make that pilgrimage to Monticello, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here I
yeah.
was, a Jersey boy. I mean, like Jefferson, okay. You know, he was cool guy, yeah, all right. He's on the nickel and the $2 bill, fantastic. And you know, here, as I'm overlooking UVA and hearing the story about the Commonwealth and how Jefferson's last words, you know, is it the 4th? And he dies on Independence Day on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration. And I couldn't help but just well up with patriotism. And I wanted to take home a souvenir with a bit more gravitas than a UVA shaky snow globe or a souvenir spoon. And I found myself in Charlottesville at Emmett Street Gourmet.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was looking for inspiration in a wine shop, of course. And I see this wall of Virginia wine. And I had gone through 2 years of wine, spirits, cigar school. And it was either wine school or law school for me. And
yeah, right.
Almost better. And so this whole wall, I'm like, wait a minute, they never even mentioned Virginia. And I see blue dogs and unicorns, mm-hmm. and butterflies. And then I saw a 1998 Sangiovese Reserve from Barbersville Vineyards. And the first thing that caught my eye was the label for its elegance. Amidst
yeah, sure.
all the color and garish noise and boisterous colors, here was a very elegant label, a grape that I knew and loved from Toscana. I saw Luca Pasquina on the label. I'm like, it's an Italian. How bad can it be, right?
So Italian.
I started reading the back label one night. I was probably out of good wine, so I thought, all right, I'll drink this wine from Virginia made by an Italian winemaker. And I was astonished. I could not believe how good the wine was. And I ended up faxing my credentials. Shows how long ago it was. I faxed my credentials to Luca.
Yeah.
And I said, I want to tell this story. And I quit my job and moved to Virginia 2 months later. And that was 10 vintages ago. The moral of that story to me wasn't just about, okay, great, I had the balls to get up and go. But
yeah.
at that time, you know, my career as a sommelier and as a writer was really beginning. And there were a lot of colleagues who were saying, what, you should go to Napa, or, you know, you wanted something interesting. You like Sangiovese, then go to Italy itself. But I said, you know what, I would have loved to have been that guy who first brought Christchurch, Marlborough, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc to America, or introduced these Nouveau Burgundian Pinots from Oregon to the East Coast. And I said, I'm going to trust my palate. I mean, no one is telling me, there were no fond reviews to trust. There was
sure.
no Parker score to lean on. I said, I'm going to trust my taste buds and hope that they can advise the textbooks later.
Mm-hmm.
And in those early years, 2002, 2003, 2004, I would call up chefs in D.C. and around the Mid-Atlantic, and I'd say, I've got this really graceful, gorgeous Viognier. I've got an effusive and elegant Cabernet Franc. And they'd say, wow, terrific, come on in. They'd say, well, where are you from? I'd say, the land's breaking up. And then I would show up and they'd be like, are you fucking kidding me, Virginia? And I really got a chance to open new business by letting them judge the wine before they judge the place. And
sure.
It's incredibly gratifying 10 years later to see the Michael Broadbent, Jancis Robinson, enthusiast, Parker's actually coming for the first time, to get Virginia on the global wine map and to say, you know what? I was drinking that shit back in 2002, and man, I told you it was good for you.
So it
feels great to watch Luca, after putting his heart into that land and putting an ear to the ground. He has been my hero. I look at him, he is such a humble and simple man. And in a business that rewards ego, that rewards press mongering, he has chosen to let Octagon do the talking.
Sure.
And instead of impressing his arrogance on the state and saying, you know what, I'm Italian, I'm gonna grow just Italian grapes, and I'm gonna tell Virginia what to do. And here's a man who's growing Viognier, who's growing Cabernet Franc, grapes that would be unlawful in his hometown,
the
province of Piemonte, because that's what the terroir told him to do. I love that.
Yeah, you know, Jason, the first time I met Luca, I think it was 1992. 92. And, you know, it was Christine Yetzi hooked us up with him. She said, you're going to really like this. And, you know, you have Clifton Inn starting. I think you should promote his wines. And we went out, and we got in his old red pickup truck. And he drove through the vineyards. And he talked about each vineyard that he has there. Because, you know, how he has the ones that are, you know, in the back, and they got a different slope, and he's got some flatter ones and whatnot. And I really didn't know that much about wine. I thought I did. And he takes us through, and he talked about each one of those vineyards like they were his child. And he was saying things I didn't know anything about, relative humidity, you know, and barometric pressure and at different times of the day. So he decided to do this grape and that grape. Because of it, and I walked away from that thinking, holy cow, this guy knows what he's talking about. It's not just, you know, someone out there, a farmer, doing some grapes. I mean, this person is passionate, and you know, and I have been really proud to be, you know, part of, you know, their chef series from the day one, and just to be around them. And to watch the whole thing unfold. But, you know, I think Viognier, and I've been telling people the Viognier from Virginia is the best in the world, because I don't get the characteristics in Viognier from any other region. It has the mouthfeel. It has the softness as well as the acidity. It has all the minerality, the herbs and everything. And I just think, I will stake my reputation on that.
Nice. You know, it has become a marker for me when I walk into a restaurant that takes its wine and spirits program seriously. There's certain things that I want to see that indicate to me a sophistication from the buyer. You know, first, of course, is the appropriateness of their list with their cuisine. Let's assume they've got that part down.
Sure.
Next is, I don't want to see the same wines there that I find in every other on every other list, nor, you know, built up on floor stacks in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see someone has taken their time, even if the bottle is only $25 on the list. You and I both know that there are plenty of really good $8.99, $9.99, $10.99 wines out there that are totally sufficient for that little mom-and-pop pizza joint when
Sure.
you're drinking it out of those short glasses that have no stems.
Mm-hmm.
So do not pour me plonk. I want to see a number of dry rosés in the summertime. I want to see grower champagnes. And don't stick Dom Perignon on your list for $275 a bottle. You know, find me some smaller independent growers. I want to see a Fino Sherry. I would love to see wines from Alsace and some of the smaller regions in France. Don't just give me all of the heavy hitters. I don't want an ego list that's front-loaded with Silver Oak and Opus One. You know, find me these little boutique-y places. And look, if you're a Morton Steakhouse, you're a Capital Grill where you have
Sure.
to appeal to sort of everyman, that's fine. Let 75% of your list be commercial. But take the rest of the list and show me some autumn regional ciders. We're seeing how the cideries are enjoying a renaissance
mm-hmm.
in Virginia. You better have Foggy Ridge on there. I want to see if there's any kind of Asian or fusion cuisine. I want to see a number of different sakes, ranging from delicate and floral to more full-bodied and rich. I want to see a craft beer list. That, okay, great, Samuel Adams may have started the whole microbrew thing, but if that's the most interesting beer on your list, you've lost me.
Mm-hmm.
So, where's, you know, Fat Tires finally made it to Virginia? Where's Come Heller High Watermelon Wheat Beer out of San Francisco? Show me something that I've never heard of that just makes me want to try it. You've got interesting taps, and you know how to pour. You've got pretty glassware. So these, to
Sure.
me, are important, and even if you're a tiny little wine bar, my favorite wine bar in Richmond is Secco.
Yeah.
And I would put Secco, you could stick it in San Francisco, you could stick it in L.A., you could stick it in NYC, heck, stick it in downtown Charlottesville, which I think is
Sure.
a really sophisticated food and wine scene, and it plays. So any restaurateur, you know, worth his ABC license has an opportunity to be contributing to the conversation and not just be a cog in the wheel who's pouring Yellowtail. Which, by the way, any listener who still drinks Yellowtail after I tell you this should unsubscribe to your podcast. Yellowtail gets its remarkably deep, rich color from Mega Purple, a food-grade dye that is added to the wine. And just like I don't want to buy the kids, you know, bath bubbles that contain, you know, yellow number 5 and red number 4, do I really want my red wine that red because someone decided that the Americans like their wines inky dark? Give it to me natural, please. Next.
So, hey, let's get back to Virginia and Barbersville. So,
all right.
That's Yellowtail, everybody. Yellowtail wine. Our producer, Mike Biseglia, has 2 bottles of Yellowtail sitting right here beside him. No, I'm just kidding, Mike. Just kidding. But so look, you know, this is all extremely interesting. Now, how could people, you know, or how do you play in when you're going to these restaurants and you're taking this wine from Virginia to these restaurants in D.C., really nice restaurants in D.C., restaurants in Richmond. How do they receive you, and how do you give them advice on their list without making them feel as if you're overstepping?
Ah, nice. Good question. Well, first of all, you mentioned that I dress well, and in the early going, you know, I was known as the guy in the hat, and everywhere that I went, I dressed like a professional. You know, yes, there are Virginia winemakers and Virginia wine salespeople who go out in Hawaiian shirts and jeans and are smoking a cigarette, taking a break, waiting for the buyer to come out.
Sure.
And you can get away with that, but I felt like I needed to be not supplicating myself, but I wanted to make sure that nothing was getting in the way of their experience of the wine, including me. And when people would say, wow, you're wearing a hat and a pocket square and a tie, I'd say, you know, I'm dressing up for the wine. I feel like Octagon is a more dressy wine, and I wanted to do the part. I don't want to drink it when I'm wearing a pair of cut-off denim trunks, so I'm not going to bring it to you wearing those. So right off the bat, I was treating the region as though it was already more formally established.
Mm-hmm.
When people go to Bordeaux, they're expecting when they pull up at the chateau of some, you know, a guy to come out wearing an ascot and, you know, have his eyes half closed. And
yeah, right.
That's just a stereotype. But we've already decided before we go there that Bordeaux, that Champagne, there's an air of fancy. And Virginia hasn't all the way established its voice, so I felt like I had an opportunity going into these restaurants to say, I'm coming here from Barbersville Vineyards. Yes, it's a new wine region, but it's an old world philosophy of wine as a food, not a cocktail.
Uh-huh.
And I'm bringing something to you that belongs on the menu alongside your regional and seasonal cuisine. And any chef who's bought into the idea that cheeses from within 100 miles deserve a place on his list if they're good, that hothouse tomatoes should not win over Hanover tomatoes, that cantaloupes from the Eastern Shore, that these foodstuffs deserve to be billed on the menu, then the wine for them makes sense.
Sure.
When you're in Puglia, on the heel of the boot of Italy, you're not drinking wines from Friuli in the northeast. You're drinking wines from the south. You're drinking Negro Amaro. You're drinking Nero d'Avola. So I wanted to impress upon them there's a regionalism in the United States that they could also champion. That why is it that you have this 100-mile dinner, but you're serving it with California wines? Does
sure.
not compute. Give me an opportunity to put them side by side. And you know, Luca was kind enough to give me a good expense account in the early days, and this is the way I would use it sometimes. I'd go into a wine shop, and I'd say, well, that's pretty expensive for a Virginia wine. I'd say, really, $40 for a Bordeaux blend. Okay, how about this? I put my card on the table. I said, you pick out what you think is the best $40 Bordeaux blend you've got in the house, and let's put them side by side. I'll open it right now. I'm buying. And if you like that one more than mine, I walk out the door. If not, you got to drink two really good wines, right? And maybe I get a spot on the list.
Yeah.
And I didn't buy too many bottles at the end of the day because they let their palates decide and go, you know what, kid in the hat?
Kid in the hat.
I'll give you the spot.
I like that.
So don't be afraid to do the takeaway, you know, and put them side by side and be willing to lose. Be willing to admit, you know what, that's a better wine than the one I've got.
Yeah.
Great. I mean, Luca at Palladio, and maybe you encounter this as well in the restaurant, there are now Virginia salumi producers, right?
Sure, yeah.
And Luca would love to go as local as possible and Chef Melissa at Palladio, but if only Salumeria can't produce a prosciutto-style ham that's at least half as good, even if it's half the price
right.
of what we're getting from Parma, then it doesn't make sense. But the fact that they've been able to make one that, hey, is really close, and
yeah,
it's
sure.
regional, and it's all natural at a competitive price, we're like, we are in. And
yeah.
I'll support them because of that.
Yeah, true enough. You know what? Now you say that, but it is kind of ludicrous that we would have these local food menus and serve wines from elsewhere. I think I've probably in the past, I was probably guilty of that a couple times. But, I have argued endlessly with people about wines from Virginia. When I was teaching at Cornell and the kids were learning about wine, from Professor Makowski, you know, I'd throw in these Virginia wines and they'd be like, come on. But you know what? I have several people now who are sommeliers, including Stephen Asprenio, who was on our show from Top Chef, who was throwing out how good the wines from Virginia are. So, you know, the work you've done and the work that Luca's done, as well as, you know, some of the other really good people of Virginia, I think is really coming to fruition, and it's a good testament to you and to the terroir, the grapes, people like Fernando over at Barbersville, these great winemakers that, blow my mind every day with how hard they work and what they're doing. But listen, real quick, because we're going to have to end this thing, I think people that are listening, what do you think is a good way for them to go out and learn more about how wine, food, and culture kind of melds together, and how can they educate themselves in those things? What would be your advice, being the modern gentleman?
Well, I'd say the two best nuggets of advice, A, is keeping a wine journal, and it's never been easier. I mean, keeping a wine journal used to be you'd peel the label off and stick it in a notebook, and it is leather bound. And these days, it's on your iPhone, it's on your iPad.
Sure.
And you write it on the back of the cocktail menu, and you slip it in your pocket. It's the best way to increase your vocabulary when it comes to food and drink. Because in the beginning, you're going to say, it was red, it was good. And the next time you say, it was red, but it was kind of more purpley red, or it was more mm-hmm. garnet red. And it wasn't just good, it was really long and deep. And before you know it, you're starting to distinguish between, you know, the brick and the older wines, how they tend to take on a browner color, and younger wines have that vibrant purple color. And when it comes to food, I play a game with my sweetheart. She has a great palate for identifying the flavors in a dish.
Sure.
And when someone asks you, what do you taste? All of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, I hadn't really thought of it. I was just thinking it was really delicious. But okay, there's lemon, but it's not just lemon. It's kind of, it's the lemon zest. Ah, and attuning, taking the fine motor control of your tongue and exercising this muscle and attaching it to your brain so that they really speak to one another in a more creative way. Don't be afraid to just say, I don't know, it's yummalicious. I mean, make up the word if you have to, but
well, we make up porkalicious all the time at the barbecue exchange.
So start to pay closer attention, and it, keeping a journal is a great way to do it. Secondly, it's never been easier to expose yourself to more authentic flavors than now. You know, when
sure,
you and I were
enough.
Kids, like, you know, going outrageous meant, you know, like, let's go out for Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's, are we going Thai? Are we going Vietnamese? Are we going Mandarin? Are we going Szechuan? Like, you know, the cultures now around us are more available. You know, I remember the first time I ever had sushi in New Jersey, and I had to go to that place, and now you can go to the grocery store.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
I say get yourself out of your comfort zone by really trying these new flavors and seeing how they move you. I've gotten my children to have more expanded palates, mainly because I didn't want to be eating mac and cheese and
yeah, right.
fingers for 18 years either. So it was, all right, kid. You guys, I would call roasted garlic candy, and now they love it. You know, they'll eat roasted beets. my kids love escargot, two of the four. Like caviar. So it's never been easier. And in this economy, you've got a lot of restaurants who are willing to give you a lot for a little. You know, wine dinners used to be $95, and now they have, like, even Dale Reitz's at Reitzer at Acacia is doing mini wine dinners for $25-$35. You get like three tapas and three half glasses of wine. And you know what? 10 years ago, 5 years ago, I don't know that he would have been able to do that for his own ego.
Right.
And he's like, man, I got kids to feed, and I've got food here that's really good. You know what? I'll give you a little. Come taste it. You're going to realize that I earned a James Beard nomination for a reason. You'll say, I'm still hungry, and then you stay in to have a whole dinner. But
a mini wine dinner. I like that. That's a good idea.
I think that you should go out once a week, and instead of going like, you're not thinking Arby's anymore, okay? Mm-hmm. Cook better at home. In this economy, it's cheaper to go buy really good ingredients. Food is my entertainment.
Yeah, right.
So I don't go to a lot of new restaurants in Richmond as much as I used to, but I am experimenting a lot at home. You know, tonight I had rabbit for dinner, and Amy and I, you know, cooked it up with some lentils and almost like cassoulet style.
Sure.
And the kids were digging in, like, we're
nice.
Making bunny jokes at the table. Rabbit is 20%. More protein and 40% leaner than chicken, and
yeah.
since there are no commercial rabbit farms, the meat's super clean and healthy.
Yeah,
so, come on, get out there,
go out there,
and drink more.
Yeah,
and write
true.
It down.
That's awesome. Well, folks, you've been listening to the Modern Gentleman, Jason DeSaro, and you can find him on themoderngentleman.com. That's themoderngentleman.com. And you can see articles in many different magazines. You can find him at wine dinners wherever you are that involve Barbersville wines. And hopefully he'll have his own podcast one day, because, you know, this guy, he has a lot to talk about. And we've enjoyed having you on tonight. Jason, what do you think? Have you had a good time?
Greg, you and Donna are two of the coolest cats. I look forward to breaking bread with both of you soon. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, no problem. And folks, you've been listening to Chew the Fat, the podcast where you hear all about your favorite food, wine, cheese, and other related items. Remember, you can find us at chewfat.net. You can find us at Seaville Podcast. Actually, you probably found us at seavillepodcast.com. Remember, SeavillePodcast.com has some outrageously good podcasts, from health to sports, current events, and all types of things, education and whatnot. So go there and check out that website. And ladies and gentlemen, this is Chef Craig Hartman out.
Anything you want at Alice's restaurant. I wasn't going to sing the song tonight. Or this decade. But I realized sometime earlier this year that it had been 26 years since this come out as a movie, and it was 2 years before that that it came out as a record. And it was 2 years ago on the record, which means it was like 30 Thanksgivings ago, 30 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I decided to go up and visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice didn't used to live in a restaurant. She used to live in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Fajit.
And anyway, like I said, this is a great podcast, but it's also listened to by my number one fan, my mom, and so we have a little tribute to her. Hi, Mom. We love you.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, Becky. Love you.
Hi, Mom.
That's it. Chew fat out.
Take the garbage down to the town dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction and headed on toward the town dump. We got there, and there was a sign, a chain across the road, and the sign said, closed on Thanksgiving. We had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And so with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset, looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one, till we come to a side road. And off of the side of the side road, there was a 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff, there was another pile of garbage. We decided that one big pile would be better than two little ones. And rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat. Went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage. Just wanted to know if you had any information about it. And I said, yes, sir, Officer Obie. I cannot tell a lie.